Welcome back, everybody, to the Deep Thought Podcast. My name is Yusuf, and today I'm joined with my co-host, Cirque.
Yo, what's up?
And Emmett.
What's up?
So today, guys, we're going to be talking about history, specifically the fall of the Ottoman Empire and the Turkish War of Independence, all the way until the formation of modern-day Republic of Turkey. So the reason we're talking about it is... we're all here Turkish background, and it's something that we obviously find interesting. And hopefully you guys, if you don't know already about this part of history, will learn something new and enjoy. And I'm just going to hand it off to my boy Emmett over here. He knows a little bit more than we do, so I guess he's going to be the one kind of guiding the history behind it all. So go ahead, bro.
Yeah, so The reason this topic is so important because it shapes even Turkey nowadays, like the formation of the government, the issues people have with Erdogan and the stuff all can be tied back to the founding of the modern Republic of Turkey and the way it was founded even. And
this is true.
Yeah, you could even say it's tied to the rise of Erdogan even, just because of the way Turkey decided to shape its policies on its founding and the way it was followed up with. But
that's interesting. I never really thought you could do that, but maybe you can discuss that a little later on towards the end of it.
Some people see him as like the modern day emperor, like a, the final emperor or some shit like that.
The final sultan.
Yeah, exactly.
Ottoman Empire, Mr. Erdogan. But no, but you can see some ties definitely with the way the modern republic was founded to why you see a rise of a leader using Islam as the base and his success and rise in power because of that. But I guess to get to the end of the story, you have to start at the beginning.
It's true. So where did it all start?
It all started with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, signing the Treaty of Versailles. And basically, the Europeans were arguing over how to divvy up the Ottoman Empire at the time. The British had occupied Istanbul. The French and Greek forces had occupied Smyrna, which is now known as the city of Izmir in today's Turkey. And you had Italian troops on the southern coast of the Mediterranean. And basically, they were all drawing up plans and arguing on who gets what and what part will belong to what, and trying to make Istanbul would have been considered an international zone to allow free trade through the Black Sea to the Mediterranean was their main ideal. The western coast was supposed to go to Greece. The southern coast was up for debate on whether French or Italian. Same with the northern. They wanted to give the northern area would have stayed the Ottoman Empire. And then the east was in arguments over who to give it to as well, whether it would go to the Armenians or go to the British who had Iraq after the war and stuff. And so basically they were at the table sitting and pretty much trying to divvy this up. And at the same time in Turkey, the final sultan was in the city of Istanbul, which was occupied by the British. And so he was sort of under surveillance by the British for everything. And so that's the reason why the Republic does not start with him, but ends with him, sort of. Like, he's not part of the independence, technically.
Wasn't he taken over to England at one point?
He flees to England when the Republic of Turkey is being founded, because Atatürk bans the royal family from Turkey.
But like, didn't Atatürk come after the signing of the treaty, or did he flee after there was like a bunch of revolutionists that were taking apart the country?
It happened during the start of the revolution. He would
have
to flee to England, and then he was not allowed back in after he fled. But yeah, so they were basically trying to divvy it up, and then Mustafa Kemal was assigned to reorganize what remained of the military units and provide internal security in the Ottoman Empire. And this was sort of used to his advantage because he was tasked with overseeing all the military left. And in the Ottoman Empire region, and basically he used that to leave Istanbul and say he's going to go reorganize the troops and instead flees to the center of Turkey in what would now be like Ankara.
So, could you just, for the people that don't know, talk a little bit about Mustafa Kemal Atatürk? Like, who is he? What's his significance? Why was he even the leader of the remaining army?
Sure. So Mustafa Kemal is a very special man to Turkish history. You can't go to Turkey without seeing his name everywhere. He would become the first president of Turkey after this independence war. But where he got his starts from, he was born in modern day Greece, actually, before it was lost to Turkey, before it was lost after World War I. And so he would join the military and sort of rise in ranks. And during this time, the military had different factions. There was the Young Turks, which is very famous for being the faction that would take over during the last ones and would be the ones that sort of perpetuated World War I and everything tied to that, as well as the Armenian genocide and everything tied with that would fall under their control. And Atatürk believed that the monarchy was no longer the proper way for the country and would fail, but he was not a member of the Young Turks and actually had very differing political opinions than the Young Turks, who sort of the Young Turks sort of wanted to enhance the Islamification of the empire and unify it again. It feels like it was falling apart, and they wanted to unify it with the Turkish ideology, but an Islamic Turkish ideology, whereas Atatürk believed in relying specifically on the Turkish ethnicity and the Turkish culture as the unifying factor of the empire. So they had differing opinions and they didn't actually like each other. And so when World War I first breaks out, the Young Turks purposely sent him into Syria, where the Ottomans were losing against the British. And they sent him right towards the end of a battle where the Ottomans were getting absolutely destroyed. And so his first command was pretty much to flee. He told all the troops that we're retreating. He organized the retreat and sort of took them back. And then, so that was supposed to be to like show him up from the Young Turks and sort of have a military embarrassment on his record. But it's arguable whether that was an embarrassment because he didn't actually fight anyone. He just saw that the situation was hopeless and instantly ordered a retreat. So it wasn't like he lost the battle. You know, he never really initiated in the first place. Then he'd be sent to the Western Front, in what is called Gallipoli. And basically, he was stationed there because they didn't really think it was going to be a big important part because the main battle areas were happening in towards Russia and towards the south of Turkey in like Iraq and Syria areas, so that he was positioned there. But unfortunately for the Young Turks, this would backfire for them because this would become the most important battle for the Ottoman Empire in terms. For Atatürk, in terms of his reputation, like in the grand scheme of things, it didn't save the empire. It delayed the inevitable, but it solidified him as a military genius. And so basically, the Battle of Gallipoli was where the British decided to try to take Istanbul by force with ships and a landing. Churchill was ac this is actually the biggest embarrassment of Winston Churchill and was his greatest defeat. And would be a black stain on his record, and he would be mocked for this for many, many years. So if you're not a fan of Churchill, then you'll enjoy this part. Whereas if you are a fan of Churchill, you'll probably say, "Oh, but Churchill didn't want a landing, and he wanted it all to be naval." And you're right, he wanted it to only be an invasion of ships. But they decided to add a landing component that was not his choice. But the defeat still falls under him. So basically, they did a two-pronged attack where they used ships that were mostly outdated to try to break into the straits of Istanbul, and they wanted to land in Gallipoli and secure the sides of the straits. And the Turks would lay sea mines in the sea that would completely prevent the ships from going through, and a lot of these were older ships that sort of fell apart. And then the land battle, they would be held back. To a stalemate, like they would get off the beach and would be able to push off the beaches of Gallipoli, but they would not be able to advance any further. And this is where Atatürk really gets his famous first speeches, where he says, like, to his troops, every Turkish person probably knows the phrase where I'm not ordering you to fight, I'm ordering you to die. and in the time that it takes for you to die, we will hope more troops to come will come and save the country. So it was sort of known that, like, he knew that it was going to be a very tough battle and that most of the people were going to die, and it was a very costly battle for the Ottomans. But in the end, they repelled the Allies. This would also, the British primarily used New Zealanders and Australians, which would also cause the independence of New Zealand and Australia as well. You know, history, everything's connected. But yeah, so.
So that's interesting. I actually had no idea that he was the commanding general, or like just a commander during the invasion in Gallipoli. And that's the first time I'm hearing about it. It's pretty interesting. When also, like, I mean, I personally still am not really a huge fan of Ataturk, but I mean, this gives him a bit more points in favor for me. So yeah. So okay. So then now skipping forward to when he was first sent over towards northern Turkey to help reorganize the land that's going to be split up. So right now we're at that time period. What does Ataturk do? What actions does he take?
So he secretly sends out letters to different generals throughout the Ottoman Empire to come together in Ankara. And he pretty much ignores the orders he was given to reassemble the Ottoman Empire troops and bring them back to Istanbul. And he just goes to Ankara and decides to set up a whole new government. And so this is where the national movement kicks off for the Ottoman, for the modern day Turkey under Mustafa Kemal Ataturk. And so, yeah, he pretty much starts it there, and he calls them in and pretty much declares the Turkish War of Independence.
Is that why the capital is in Ankara to this day?
Yes, so that is the reason why Ankara is the capital to this day. Because it was central to the country, and it's where he started his military operations. And in this War of Independence, they will be fighting Greece on the Western Front and Armenians on the Eastern Front. So he needed a point that wasn't too close to either, where, you know, you could be captured or whatever. And it's a good center point of Turkey even today. If you look on a map, it's pretty central to the whole country. But yes, because he started it there is why it's the capital to this day.
Yeah, that's true. I feel like nowadays in modern day time, it doesn't really matter where you put your capital. Anybody from any country, any military force can really easily access any city through like sending parachuting infantry or just sending out missiles from, you know, miles, hundreds of miles away and just pinpoint targeting those locations. But given the time period, it is a very tactical and strategical decision to put the capital there.
And everyone thinks the capital is Istanbul, but if you're Turkish, you know that it's not.
Yeah, everybody that
well, some Turks might not even know. But
I mean, I'm pretty sure every single Turk knows. Like, I mean, you could probably argue maybe Turkish people that were born outside of the country and don't really have too many strong ties to the country might not know. But I feel like if you have relatives that you speak to, you know, frequently in Turkey, then you would still, at the very least, know where the capital is.
Yeah, I mean, it's not surprising that people don't know that Ankara is the capital. It's not a well-known city, whereas Istanbul was the capital of the Ottoman Empire for like 600 right. years.
And is it Ankara in the middle of a desert?
I don't know if it's technically. I think it's considered a steppe region.
Yeah, it looks so barren. I mean, I've never been there personally, but whenever I've seen like any photos of the area,
I've been
or, like,
there.
Some satellite
it's very
pictures.
Barren.
Wait, we went there on our trip in 2015, didn't we?
Yeah.
We didn't go to Ankara.
Yeah, we did.
Did we?
We definitely did.
I don't remember that.
I know.
Do we meet somebody there?
We went to Çorum, which is slightly north of Ankara.
I remember Çorum. I didn't think we actually went any
further south.
We
did stop
in
Ankara. I know that. I don't think we spent a lot of time there, though.
It was probably just like a quick pit stop.
But yeah, there's nothing around. It's all barren, pretty much all around it. The city itself is not an attractive city. It's not a beautiful city, I will
right.
say.
It's a very wide city, right?
Yeah, I would say so. But yeah,
kind of like DC. So. There's nothing too special about DC.
Yeah,
it's interesting. So yeah, moving on. So right now, Ataturk has sent his letters out to these generals, and right now the rebellion has started, and he's at war with all these foreign occupying nations.
And so in response, when he declares the Grand National Assembly in Ankara as the new Turkish parliament or the new Turkish capital, the allies tried to round up all leading members of the Turkish military forces, of the Ottoman military forces, but a bunch were able to escape. And some were very well-known generals that were able to escape at the time. So that definitely helped a lot with the nationalist movement in Turkey. And so the war will be fought on multiple fronts. Some were easier than others to win. Some they didn't have to fight as much, but the two main fronts would be in the east and the west as the majority, because the French would flee the south after like the first battle against the Greeks, because they didn't want to get into a fight.
I mean, what war has the French not fled from?
Most of history, actually, besides World War II. But
just memeing it up.
Yeah, so
I'm sorry
in the east,
if you're a French listener.
So in the east, you had the Republic of Armenia and the Ottoman Empire that had some treaties defined after the end of World War One, I mean. And so basically they start going into this war, they start fighting. It wasn't super heavy fights. There was two reports from a guy named Kazım Karabekir, who outlined the situation, and he was like detailing the activities of the Armenian Republic and how to like what resources they'll need on the Eastern Front. Unfortunately, the Armenians would fall to a Bolshevik revolution in their own country. And so while trying to fight the Turkish forces and the Bolsheviks, their country kind of implodes, and the Bolsheviks in the country sign a treaty that was heavily favored towards Turkey.
So from what I've read myself and the research I've done, as far as I understand, there really wasn't like too much fighting between Turkey and the revolutionists in Turkey and the Armenian army, not because of the revolution per se, because that happened later in the war, I think like a few months, maybe a year into the war. But I think it was because of, since it was so mountainous there, there really wasn't too much like land to really fight over. And at the same time, there really wasn't, the Armenians didn't really have a huge army to begin with. It was more of like skirmishes. Maybe like, I think the Armenians had like a couple hundred people are in each other armies. And then the Turkish armies would have like a few hundred more. So it was more of like the Armenians kind of holding a position and I'm on a, you know, one of their cities or towns. And then they would, once they saw the larger or Turkish army moving forward, they would kind of retreat and try to get into better positioning. But that pretty much just led to them making, fully retreating all the way into their own country. And then, like you were saying, it eventually led to, the point where when they're fully retreated into their country, their own, revolution happened. And, at the same time, before, like, so that revolution, when that happened in the Armenian government, the day before that the Bolsheviks took over, they the Armenian government and the Turkish government signed a treaty saying like to end the war. And then literally the next day the Bolsheviks took over. So that treaty that they signed actually was void. It wasn't valid anymore because that government that Turkey signed with did not exist anymore. So technically Turkey was at war with the Armenians for another year, I think, until the Soviet government and the Armenian Bolshevik government got together with the Turkish national government and they formed a new treaty. But I think there was still a ceasefire after the Bolsheviks took over.
Yeah, I mean, the important part here is there's some really key straits in that mountain region in the Caucasus, and this is was a vital interest of Turkey to keep control of. And so there's not a lot to fight over. It's not a huge resource grab, but it's more like these straits are key positions in battle and in war. If you ever go to war, if you control the strait, you control whoever can set up in the strait first and defend it has the advantage, pretty much. So Turkey wanted to make sure it had these straits. So that was pretty much what they got out of the Eastern Front. So, yeah, the Bolsheviks didn't really want to fight that much. So,
Then let's move on towards the Western Front. So
sure.
how did the Kemalist movement and the revolutionists, how did they go about handling the Western Front?
So the Western Front was occupied by Greece, and so, the Triple Entente decided that Greece would control a zone around Izmir and a place called Ayvalık in western, modern-day Turkey. So they landed on this area and sort of just decided to hold on to it. And so this is where a lot of the conflicts would come, and the Greeks start marching forward, and start extending their terrain as they keep going. And in response, Ataturk would march west, but before that, he had to take care of some unrest in his own country. There's some famous unrest that happened in Yozgat, a city of Yozgat, that was against Ataturk. And so he had to go, and there's very famous sayings like that Ataturk said, like, I can defeat the Greeks any day, but first I have to take care of my own people because they're the real threat. And so there was uprising against the nationalist movement in Yozgat that was still loyal to the Sultanate. And so he had to first go into Yozgat and put down the uprising. And then he would start marching west. And so he would march west against the Greeks, and there would be a couple battles. And then luckily, there would be some famous battles where there was close battles where it actually looked like they might win, where the Greeks might win. But in the end, Ataturk would dominate and eventually push all the way to Smyrna or Israel. They called it the Great Offensive, or in Turkish, the Büyük Taarruz. And it
And they
was the,
dumped them in the ocean. Okay.
kind of. I mean, they didn't really have anywhere else to go, so they had to retreat into the ocean, into the sea, and get picked up by boats. But,
Did the Kemalist movement, did they have their own ships and their own navy?
not really. They did have some leftover from the Ottomans, but they didn't really fight any naval battles during this. It was all pretty much land battles. And Turkey didn't even have much motorized vehicles, so most of their forces was infantry and cavalry, and they actually used ox carts as supply lines. So it was kind of a very old style compared to what every other country was doing at the time with motorized vehicles. But yeah, the Great Offensive towards the West would begin with the Battle of Dumlupinar, where Mustafa Kemal defeated a superior Greek army within 4 days. And this battle was like the last chance of Greece to push back the Turkish army. And like after this battle, it was just constant retreating by the Greeks. It was just nonstop retreat all the way till Izmir. And then, yeah. So they would
Quick
just.
question. Was he still fighting, and like, would he still identify as as an Ottoman at this point, or was like the new movement like more prevalent in terms of how like who he was fighting for or who he was leading?
I mean, he would not have called himself an Ottoman at this point, because he declared the Grand National Assembly, and he's saying he was
Right.
f fighting on the behalf of the Parliament of Turkey. So it wouldn't have been like, oh, I'm an Ottoman or something. Like he strictly was against the Ottoman government,
Right.
which was supporting the Allies at this time, not by choice, but they were still on the sides of the Allies.
Yeah, I think if he was to actually identify himself as an Ottoman successor, then it would kind of give a reason for the British to probably full force into the c country and then take over the war for Greece. I mean, because at this point, they're not directly battling the Turkish national government or the national army. They're just providing aid to the Greeks. They're providing them with resources, guns, food, clothing, all that stuff for the army to maintain their occupation and their battling. So, I mean, I think it was a smart move by Atatürk, regardless of if he felt himself that he was an Ottoman, because declaring himself would have evidently probably brought back the greater nations and probably wiped out and maybe not even have a modern day Turkey today.
So was his like idea to pretty much form a new republic, was that seen as favorable at the time as the by the Western countries yet or no?
Yes and no. Like, once the war ended, the fact that he went for a more Western style was respected by the West. And I think it was in part like one of the thoughts of Mustafa Kemal when he did this, like, because during this time, right, everyone had their colonies and he didn't want Turkey to become another colony of these European nations. And so how do you not become a colony, right? You become like the Europeans. It's the same philosophy Japan had as well, where they chose, like, instead of becoming a colony of Europe, you become like the Europeans. And so that was sort of by modernizing it and making it like the European style, like, for example, the outfits, right? He banned the old Ottoman style outfits and it was now suit and tie and top hats style. Right. And so he like really pushed towards adapting a Western thing and like even changing the alphabet to Latin, which is what most of the Western countries use. England, Germany, France, all of them use the Latin alphabet. So,
yeah, and because of that, there's a lot of controversy even to today. A lot of Turkish people really you know, quote that as like a reason why they don't really like Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, because he pretty much just took away the old ways that we are, the original ways of our culture and our society, and he made it more into like the Westerners. Because there was still stigma, and still today there is stigma towards Westerners. How, you know, we're obviously not Westerners. We're in the middle of the world, the Middle East, primarily. So changing really the culture and society did have a lot of like backlash, but not to the point where people were rising up. It was more just like people complaining a lot and really having like, I guess you probably could say there was some pushback, but since there was the government was forcefully mandating a lot of this stuff, you really didn't want to be the, you know, person that stood up, even if like you really did believe in it. Who's to say that your neighbor that also agrees with you will stand up with you? It's like that whole stigma of like, or the thought of like, you know, will the people actually stand with me? Like who am I? Like, no one knows me. I'm not somebody like Atatürk that has any type of influence. So it's just kind of like people kind of let it happen, which, I mean, you can easily argue it's good or bad. It's really just up to opinion.
I mean, here's the thing. Like, during that time, nobody was going to argue with him. Like, this was the man who saved the country. He literally rescued Turkey from the Allies, and so nobody was going to argue with him. Like, he pretty much had pretty much free reign for the early years. Later on, you will see a shift in his policies where you can see he gets pushback from some of the policy he passed to try to make it more Western. And for those policies, like, you can see that like his popularity towards his last years in office was sort of waning, as opposed to when he first came in and changing everything dramatically. Nobody really argued with him and sort of adapted to it, because, I mean, how do you argue with the guy that literally saved your country from collapse? Like, it's kind of,
you just gotta deal with it. Like, goddamn, yeah. I can't wear a fez anymore. I'm lucky.
No, exactly. Fez.
I think it's more, you see really more of these complaints and comments more retrospectively rather than during the time period.
Yeah, but there was pushback during the time, especially when it came towards more Islamic things, as opposed to having like dress or like what language your alphabet is in. But when it came to religious stuff, there was a lot of pushback against him.
At one point the government make it so that the azan, the call to prayer, was forced to be read in Turkish?
Yeah, and sort of his statement on that is people should know what they're hearing, like they should know what it means. But at the same time, like, it just doesn't sound right in Turkish because it wasn't made to be done in Turkish. So there was backlash on that.
I personally don't really think there's anything wrong with hearing anything like in the Quran being translated. Because, like, if it's not translated, how are you going to spread it to people that don't know Arabic? You know, you can't just force people to learn a whole new language, especially for people that are either stubborn or they're older and they just fall into the mentality of, oh, I'm too old, I can't learn this or whatever. But, like, I think, like, the easiest way to really spread a religion, no matter what it is to bring it to these people in their own religion, or sorry, in their own language, so they have a better understanding of it.
Right. I kind of had a bit of a side note about that. Earlier today, I was talking to one of my friends, Tuna, and we were talking about how, I was talking to him about how, like, my dad would, like, make us read some Quran. Like, he'd be like, oh, read 5 pages of Quran today. And I'd be like, no. Because, like, really, like, it's like, you know how to read it, but you have zero clue what it's saying because you don't understand the language. So it's kind of pointless in that regard. So maybe some parts were a little justified to try to understand your religion more. But at the same time, he broke a lot of traditions that people weren't cool with.
Yeah, and I mean, there's like, there's value in it, in its original language, even if you don't understand what you're reading, right? There's the flow to it. There's like, it's like reading poetry. Like, it's actually like, if you read the Quran in Arabic, it flows like poetry. And so a lot of people think this is the beauty of it, and you're sort of taking the beauty of the Quran that is given by God and is this poetry, right? And you're sort of turning it into just regular sentences. And so people are like, but then, like, you're taking away from the beauty of the words of God. Like, there's a whole research you can do on, like, how the Quran is, like the passages are shaped in certain ways and how they flow in certain ways that are considered, like, lyrically very amazing things that have been done. Like, and so, like, a lot of people were like, if you're taking that away from it, then this is a problem because it's losing its value, right? It's turning into a regular book instead of this holy book.
Yeah, I would agree. Whenever I go to a mosque, which is very rare, and like I hear a imam or someone that just really knows how to read the Quran in the way it's meant to be read, it just sounds so beautiful.
Sounds amazing. Yeah.
Like, I don't understand a word that they're saying. I'll catch like maybe a couple words here and there that I've, you know, translated myself to, or someone's told me what the specific word means, but I don't know what they're saying. But every time you hear it, it's just so like moving, and it just makes me, you know, it just like, it's like music to my ears. You know, it's amazing. So after, where were we at? So right now, the
capture of Izmir.
Yeah, capture of Izmir, and then afterwards. So right now, is that when the Greeks were defeated, or was there more to it?
That's pretty much when the Greeks were defeated. Like, he captured some of the head generals, and this is where like the conference of Lucerne will begin, and it starts on.
Is that how you pronounce it?
It's a friend. It's in Switzerland. So I have no idea.
I thought it was, well, I mean, Turkish people say Lausanne. So I don't know. I've just been going off of that.
That's a Turkish accent, but I think it'd be Lausanne. I don't know.
Who knows, man? Swiss.
In French.
Yeah, Switzerland speaks German, don't they?
What do they speak? German, like, French, like, and Italian.
It's literally like a mix.
Depending on which region. They don't have an official language, right?
Yeah, it depends on the region. So I think that's more on the French side, Lausanne. But yeah, so the conference would begin, and pretty much the modern borders would be defined by that of what it is today and divides everything up, as opposed to the Treaty of Sèvres, which was supposed to be the one that split up the Ottoman Empire specifically. Like, Treaty of Versailles ends World War One, but the Treaty of Sèvres was going to split up the Ottoman Empire specifically. So the Treaty of Sèvres gets annulled and gets replaced with the Treaty of Lausanne, which defines the modern borders of Turkey. And so thus begins the modern Republic of Turkey.
Damn. Turkey would have been tiny without it.
Yeah, I know, right? There's so much land that was occupied.
If anybody looks at the Treaty of Sèvres, it's a lot smaller than what Turkey would be today.
So going to the Treaty of was it Lausanne, that aside from, you know, making clear the borders of modern-day Turkey, I'm sure it did more than that. Was there any other, like, specific points that are pretty important even to today that you would that they had in the treaty?
They revoke all claims to the rest of the Ottoman Empire was another one. They had some laws on how the straits would work, but those would be replaced like 13 years later in 1936 because it was too complicated, so they wanted to simplify it. And those were some of the big stuff.
Wasn't there any something about like minerals and mining? Wasn't there like limitations? Because I keep hearing a lot of Turkish people, especially in like when people are talking about the Treaty of Lausanne today in like the news, or if my I listen to my dad speak about it, a lot of people are saying there's like a lot of limitations for the Turkish government to really not like specifically mine, but like the utilization of the resources that we mine. Is like, do you know anything about that?
To be honest, I'm not quite sure. I have heard like Erdogan himself seeks to institute certain revisions of the treaty, but I don't know myself the specifics on what exactly they had to give up in the treaty that
they're so opposed to. Is that the one that expires in 2023 or something?
Yeah, technically, because it's 100 years right after the signing of the treaty.
1923 was the signing of the Treaty of Lausanne.
Yeah.
All right. So yeah, so we have the treaty signed. The border, modern day Turkish borders are defined, and then now, so what happened like specifically after that? Was it like Atatürk immediately given presidentship, or was there some sort of elections put into place? Like what happened exactly?
He said, so, "I am the Senate."
I am the Senate. So pretty much starts with like the General National Assembly comes together, the Grand National Assembly, and sort of lays out exactly the meaning, and he's elected from the Grand National Assembly to be the first president.
President.
He was chosen to be the first president, and İsmet İnönü was the chief of the general staff. Yeah, İnönü was declared the chief of general staff, and Atatürk pretty much had full control at that point. To shape the country how we wanted.
So nobody like said, I mean, well, obviously no one could really say anything because he's not the Turk, but like
say no.
the assembly just like literally said, hey, go do whatever the fuck you want. Like they didn't like,
it
was pretty much unanimous like for him. And I mean, he formed the National Assembly, so it's full of people who were of his mindset.
His yes
that's
man.
True yeah
so
that's true, yeah, I guess that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, so because of that, they were 100% in support of anything he said, and so he introduced many reforms, and he wanted to transform it from this religion-based multi-communal constitutional monarchy into a nation state with a parliamentary republic with a secular constitution. And that's an important part of it, because in the Turkish government, religion and law were completely separated, as opposed to Ottoman law, which was mixed with Quranic law, or Sharia law was mixed in throughout. It was modernized, and it was based more on this French policy under the Ottoman Empire towards the last centuries, but it still had a lot of things based off of Sharia law, and instead he removed all combinations of religion in it.
So yeah, speaking about the separation of church and state and keeping the government secular, I think it's actually pretty amazing how they were able to achieve that, and how it's still maintained to this day. If you go to Turkey now, you know, like for example, eating pork is a sin. It's one of the biggest sins you could commit in Islam, and
I don't know if I would say it's one of the biggest, but I guess that's up to debate.
I mean, I guess it depends on who you ask, really. But regardless, it's still a pretty big sin.
Murder.
People will do everything before they eat pork, though.
It is funny, though, yes.
That's true. I'll see people that either smoke weed, they'll fucking drink alcohol, and, you know, all that stuff. And then they won't, like, once you say, like, here, you want some pork, they'll be like, Estağfurullah, Abi, no. Like, people will just, like, go crazy over that. Anyways, besides the point, obviously it's debatable how big of a sin it is, but it's still pretty big, if you ask any Muslim. But like today, you can go to Turkey, you can go to almost any restaurant, and you know a lot of them will be serving pork. There's nothing.
I would add a caveat that you'd have to
Depends
be in a tourist region.
I guess that's true too. Yeah, it'd be more on a tourist year because it's more catered towards tourists because the country is, well, like 95%, almost 99% Muslim.
Alcohol would be more widespread though today.
Alcohol is very widespread. I mean, they even have an official drink. They have the official alcohol, the rakı.
Yeah.
Yeni rakı.
What they call the lion's milk in Turkey because it's white when you mix it with water.
Yeah, so like, you can go to Turkey and like tourist years, you can eat pork. Alcohol, almost anywhere, any city you go to, you can find at least one store that's selling alcoholic beverages. And at the same time, there are churches there in Turkey. It's not, I mean, obviously it's not going to be predominant, but there's still, like, no one says anything. And I think it's really amazing how this majority, 95 to 99% Muslim population, allows these non-Muslim beliefs to be prevalent, which, I mean, it's not really surprising because in Islam, it's already preached that you should love everybody and treat everybody with respect, regardless of what they believe, who they are, where they've come from. You know, don't let anybody tell you otherwise that, you know, these don't look at the extremists, ISIS, you know, the other terrorist groups in the Middle East.
But Sharia
law. Islam is a very... I don't know who she is, but like it's like almost any other religion. You can say the same thing with Hinduism or Buddhism. There's extremists in every group in Christianity, and there's also the good, like the majority of people that are good and loving and accepting, and it be maintained as a secular nation is really, I think, one of the greatest feats that the Turkish society, the Turkish government has really achieved throughout the almost 100 years of its, since its foundation.
There's some very amazing things that this constitution gave that was considered like maybe even more modern than a lot of what's considered modern countries to this day. Like it gave the right to vote to anyone above age 18, man or woman, which at this time, you know, the U.S. didn't give the right to vote until 1920. So it's only 4 years after the U.S. So coming from a constitutional monarchy to a whole new country, giving everyone the right to vote, it was a pretty big deal. Lots of European countries still hadn't given women the right to vote by 1924. So it was even ahead of a lot of what is considered Western today. Mandated the 4 years term limits.
How many terms did Atatürk serve?
I want to say he served 2 and then died in office.
Did he die in office?
Yeah, he died in office.
Okay, I didn't know about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so with Atatürk, didn't he also?
It's hard to tell because, like, right, this doesn't start until the Constitution starts. Constitution 1924.
Yeah, you would need a law in place to really define that.
Yeah,
but correct me if I'm wrong. Wasn't Atatürk the one that formed the CHP party? Well, the party's in the acronym, but didn't he form it?
I don't know off the top of my head.
I think he did. I'm pretty sure he did.
I'm not too sure about that.
I'm not too familiar with
it. Because a lot of people, a lot of Turkish people today, they still call this, they call CHP Atatürk's party. Okay, all right.
Yeah, it's the oldest political party in Turkey.
And it's the second largest party right now, be right behind the AKP.
Right behind Erdogan's party.
Yeah, Erdogan's party.
Just since AKP is not going to mean anything to most people.
That's true. I should clarify whose party that is.
Say the Republican People's Party was Atatürk's party, and it still exists today. And the Justice and Development Party would be the party of Erdogan.
Yeah, so those acronyms I just said, those are the Turkish acronyms.
There's a shit ton of parties beyond that, though. It's not like the U.S. where it's just Democrat versus Republican.
No, it's a multi-party state.
Those are the two main ones.
Yeah, but in today's government, the majority ruling party is the AKP, Erdogan's party, and then right behind, like I said, is CHP, which is Atatürk's party. So after the constitution was signed, put into place, how did everything that's happened since the beginning of the revolution up until Atatürk's death, how has that shaped what modern-day Turkey is like?
Well, it's important to talk about certain provisions that were passed for it. For example, the military is considered in Turkey not under the executive branch, like it is in the US or in other countries, but instead it's its own separate entity. And its duty, one of its duties, besides defending the nation and fighting in the wars, is to ensure that the government stays secular. And this is a very unique model compared to all other nations. And so in Turkey, we've had the military is allowed to do a coup d'etat against the leader.
I wouldn't say allowed to,
Yes, they are
but
allowed
they're
to.
able to.
Constitutionally, they are
Wait, it's
allowed.
in the
It's in the
Constitution? Atatürk set it
Constitution.
up like that, right?
Yes, he set it up like that if it's leaning away from secularism, the military is allowed to do a coup d'etat against the government. But
Damn, I gotta brush up on my history.
as a unified one, so they have to be unified in their choice to do it. It can't be like one sector of the military doing it like it was with that attempted coup a couple years ago.
2016.
2016.
But yeah, I think that's a good idea to keep it separate, because like here in the US, for example, since the military is directly under the executive branch has a capability, specifically the president, to order troops to be sent anywhere for, I think it was up to 30 days, 60 days, something like that, before the Congress has to decide whether or not a declaration of war is going to be declared in Parliament
I
or in
mean, there's
Congress.
positives and downsides. Like having it as the separate, there was a lot of coup d'etats that happened for reasons that were not because secularism was under threat in Turkey. It was because the military didn't agree with what politics were going to be brought up. Like, for example, when the president Adnan Menderes decided to take money from the United States to build highways in Turkey and join that side, the military overthrew him and hanged him for choosing that side, because Turkey wanted to they wanted to stay neutral and didn't want to anger the Soviets, because the Cold War was happening and Turkey's right next to the Soviet Union, and they were worried this was going to cause Turkey to be invaded by the Soviets. And so he was, for example, he was hanged by the military for that. And nowadays people view that as one of the stupidest things ever, because of these highways. Turkey has amazing roads because of this man, pretty much. Like, this president took that money and invested in infrastructure. And like, we have many lanes, like 4 or 5 lane highways that aren't even like fully packed yet. So like, it's amazing for traffic and stuff thanks to him. But
You're talking about Adnan Menderes, right?
yeah.
I think after he was hanged, they pardoned him
Yeah,
afterwards, and then now he's like a bunch of schools and like roads and shit are named after
that's
him.
very useful.
Yeah, right.
It's so great to be pardoned after you're dead.
It's like within in the UK when they chemically castrated and shamed Alan Turing. One of the key he's like one of the key people when it came to decoding messages. What happened to him? Is he gone?
Probably
Hopefully
logged
he'll
out.
join back. Just letting you guys know now, Emmett looks like he might have logged out of our call. He'll probably join back. But anyways, going back to Alan Turing, he was the key comp people when it came to decoding World War II messages. Are you good now, Emmett?
I'm fine. Don't ask.
All right.
I don't know what's up with
He's
my connection right now,
So he's
too.
actually the reason that we have modern day computers as well. He brought up he pretty much lined up not lined up created a lot of the basic principles that we use today in modern day computing, and he also brought about a lot of the ideas when it comes to AI. And he was a homosexual, and because of that, the British government, they chemically castrated him and shamed him for being a homosexual. And because of that, he was extremely depressed and very suicidal and ended up killing himself. And then I think in the 90s, the Queen pardoned him and gave him some sort of medal. I can't remember the specific medal, but like that's like what I was saying about Adnan Menderes. It's very convenient that they do it after he's like gone, and like this man that actually benefits so much the country.
Yeah, and there was a time in Turkey in the 80s where there was politically, Turkey was very divided between communists and nationalists, and they would literally fight in the streets and people would kill each other in the streets. This actually heavily affected my own father, who lived in Çorum, and Çorum was one of the hotbeds for this conflict. And my father actually almost died because of this, because he walked into the wrong part of the town he lived in that was like controlled by the communists, and so they started throwing rocks at him. And like, qu an older man quickly picked up my dad and like took him back. But yeah,
Damn.
Like, it was
just, damn, kudos to the old guy.
Yeah, so it was really bad. And the military did a coup d'etat and removed the president of that time because they felt like he wasn't handling both sides very well. And the military took over and arrested both sides, pretty much, and sent them all to prison. Like, anyone that was affiliated was sent to prison. And
who was the president at the time?
I do not
know. Was that Özal?
I think it could have been, yeah.
I'm just gonna quickly look this up.
But
what year was? Would you say it was 1980s?
It was 1980s, and that would lead to the leader before Erdogan, which was considered a very inefficient leader because they put in a very neutral person who didn't really do much for Turkey, so that he wouldn't be overthrown. I believe
it was in 1980, right?
1980s. I'm not off the bat.
That was Demirel. Was that him? I think that was him. I vaguely remember my parents mentioning Demirel.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure off the top of my head. But I just know that yeah, one of the leaders was overthrown. And so, like, for example, those were times where having the military separate has caused issues and stuff like that. And also, under Atatürk, they went very anti-Islam, where, like, under his government and stuff, they banned wearing headscarves in offices. Like, you could not work for the government and wear a headscarf as a woman. That was all banned. That as a man, you could not wear any of the traditional Ottoman outfits and work for the government. He banned a lot of the Sufi orders in Turkey, and Sufi is sort of the mystical side of Islam. And so you have a lot of certain sects of Turkish people that were very upset about this, as Yusuf's family could probably attest, because they're Süleymancı's, which is one of the sects that were banned from Turkey under Atatürk. True.
I mean, Sirk, and him, his family too, a little bit into Süleymancı's as well.
Yeah, you know, we were dabbling with it here and there because, you know, education and all that. But I would say nowadays, my parents don't really coincide with any sect. It's really just the Diyanet, which would be the government funded.
That's also so the government now funds the religion and controls the imams and everything and decides who becomes imam.
Atatürk's rolling in his grave about that one, probably.
But I mean it is ironic, since the government was formed to be secular. Now we have a government religion.
I mean, that was through Atatürk, that it was the first constitution declared the state religion to be Islam and to be Turkish the official language. So this is what I mean when he got This is what I mean when he got pushback. Like, originally, like, you can hear quotes from him being very anti-Islam and saying, like, Islam is a curse for Turkey, it's a disease or whatever. And then towards the end, like, when forming the constitution and the end of his life, he said, we have to find a balance between church and between mosque and state for Turkey.
Right.
Instead of not church and state, less
than churches. Because eventually, like, he would even attend, like, Friday prayers at a mosque.
So... And so he got pushback on that, and so he realized, like, you can't take a 99% Muslim population and be like, nope, no religion now, right? So that's why he had to work, and that's why to him it was better to have the government control it than have it be completely independent. And so that's why the religion is the government controlled in Turkey as opposed to independent, because there was a lot of different sects in Turkey, and they were all arguing with each other and fighting with each other. And causing conflicts. So he just outright banned all of them, even though some preached like everlasting love and were peaceful and everything. Like, you see the dervishes, the whirling dervishes, if anybody is also a sect of Islam, of Sufism, that was banned under Atatürk, that would be brought back for tourism reasons because it brings in a lot of money for Turkey, because people love seeing these men and women, you could be any gender and join them actually, just spin for hours and hours and hours without stopping.
For hours? Yeah. I thought it was for like a little bit. Like,
no, they spin for hours.
Jesus.
They go into like a trance when they do it.
Looks like it. I mean, seeing the footage can be a little creepy. They just like got the straightest face ever.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're after the coup in the 80s, we're heading into the 90s. So right now, a new party is born. I think it was in the early or mid 90s, late 90s, the Erdogan's party. Correct, right?
Yeah.
Well, the party existed, but he kind of just like took over.
I thought he was the one that formed it.
Are you talking about AKP? AKP?
Yeah.
I thought
he was the one that formed it.
After Adnan Menderes was hanged.
According to this, it was founded by Erdogan in 2001.
In 2000, oh, okay, so it was actually early 2000.
I was thinking of the Justice Party. It was the Adalet Party.
Yeah, that was slightly different.
This is like the Justice and Development Party. Okay, got it.
Yeah,
I see. So yeah, we have we have Erdogan's party, the AKP, the Justice and Development Party, form in the early 2000s, and then this is actually interesting because him and Erdogan and his party, they gained so much appeal and attraction that like I said before, today it's the largest party in the government and it's the most popular. So speak about like how the party was formed.
Sure.
What was specifically, what did Erdogan do?
So it's very funny because originally it was a very pro-Western, pro-American party. But they wanted to sort of bring back social things that were banned. Like, for example, allowing women to wear whatever they want and be in offices. So like you no longer were banned from, because like I had a cousin, for example, who before Erdogan's party was in power, became a doctor, but she refused to take off her headdress, so they wouldn't let her be a doctor. She was not allowed just because she wouldn't take it off. And so Erdogan's party sort of reversed this finally after all these years, and it gained a lot of support for reforms like that. And they did a lot of healthcare and housing reforms, better healthcare. Like everyone under the age of 18 in Turkey has automatic free healthcare. As a child, you don't need to get healthcare or anything. Everything's paid for. They improved rights for minorities and religious minorities, like the Kurdish people's alphabet and names were banned before Erdogan, and he unbanned them in the beginning of his party. Like Turkey's average income rose from like $2,800 all the way up to like $10,000. So this was a huge jump in economic boost, which is why he had so much influence for so long.
And he still does today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, today he lost Istanbul and Ankara in the most
recent. Yeah, that's true. Didn't he lose it to CHP?
I believe so. Which typically in Turkey, they have a saying that whoever controls Istanbul controls the prime ministership. So We'll see who wins the next Turkish election, but it seems like this may be his last.
It's like the tipping point.
Yeah. So, but basically they tried to push for a liberal market economy. They tried to get Turkey in the EU, and they were like trying everything they could to support all this. But this is sort of where Erdogan would take a shift in his roles. Like he was working together with Fethullah Gülen as well in the beginning. Which is a very infamous man in Turkey, if anybody knows him. But basically, he's an Islamist that wants to bring like religion back in and run the Turkish government in his own way with his own idea of Islam. And so, obviously, it goes against the secular ideas of Turkey. And so, there was a huge. He sort of ran the underground of the Turkey. Like you couldn't get into a position of power without being like tapped by him, and so that's why Erdogan was friends with him, and that's how he gets his rise into power. But make no mistake, Fethullah Gulen was a very evil and corrupt man. Like he purposely made up fake papers in Word documents and put them on people's computers to arrest them, saying they're trying to do a coup and take over the government, and he had multiple people arrested just because they opposed him, with nothing but Word documents that said, I support this coup, and like absolutely ridiculous evidence. And like people like later went in and looked at the metadata of this document. It was clear that it was not created on this computer at this time, anything to do with it. Like it was made the day before the people were arrested and stuff. Like, but basically they have a falling out, and Erdogan would reveal this happened and sort of reverse the sentences on those people, and Gulen would flee Turkey.
Just going back to the beginnings of Erdogan's political career and the AKP, from what I've heard from my parents and from my family members in Turkey, most of them support Erdogan. And even if they don't like support him fully today, they still, at the very least, give him the They credit. Still attribute a lot of the credit. They attribute a lot of the economic growth and the social growth, pretty much everything about Turkey today. He brought so much so much to so many different parts of Istanbul, specifically a lot of electricity, clean water, internet, TV, all this stuff. Like the place that the part of Istanbul that my family lives in right now is Tuzla, which is the one of the most eastern parts of the province. That place was described to me as like a village, a very small village. But if you go there today, it's now bustling, like a urban suburban area, and there's so many people. It's jam packed. I can't imagine it ever being a village because I've only seen it in that state. But my family, like my grandparents, describe it as like a poor area. They would tell me about times how they would be struggling to even provide and put food on the table, you know, even get like just a piece of bread. It was very difficult. And when Erdogan and his party came in, they changed everything. They gave all these people clean water, electricity, like I said. They pretty much made Turkey into a first world country. Where, you know, nobody before, like pre-early 2000s, no one would really look at Turkey as like a power at all. As they would just see, oh, this is another third world country. They don't really have much. But now today, if you mention Turkey, I mean, I don't think anyone or everybody would really know too much about Turkey. But people that are well-versed in world history or the current state of the world, they would still be able to tell you that Turkey, yeah, it's a pretty modern country. There's a lot of research being done, things like that. I mean, there's aspects there that you could argue is not modern, but you can't argue with a lot of the, like, for example, education, or like you were saying before, the healthcare system, infrastructure. It is very modernized. If you go there, you would be like, oh, this looks like another European country or something like that.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing, right? Like Erdogan's rise is tied can be tied to policies Atatürk passed, like banning of the headscarves, right? That was a very popular thing they did. And also reigning in the military was also something very popular that happened under Erdogan, where they put the military under civilian rule, as opposed to the military being completely separate from everything else. And so by having it more under civilian rule, it prevents those coups that have shaped Turkey multiple times throughout its history in mostly bad ways, I would say. Most of these coups were not legitimate to ensure the constitution and stuff, and were really messed up, and innocent people were hanged and arrested because of it. So yeah, and so that sort of leads to the rise of Erdogan, and then Erdogan takes a turn in his policies that are very different from when he first came into power, which is where him and I stopped being friends.
Yeah, today a lot of Turkish people really don't like Erdogan for his more recent policy changes and laws. What would you say specifically most people really disagree with today?
Censorship.
Censorship. He completely got rid of freedom of speech, yes, pretty much. Definitely. Like all the media is pretty much state-owned at this point, because he took over the media companies, and like freedom of speech is one of the things that's protected under the constitution. That's sort of fallen behind. He's arrested a lot of people without really proving that they were involved in anything. Like when the coup happened in 2016, there was hundreds and hundreds of people arrested, and I highly doubt...
Not even hundreds. There was thousands of people arrested. There's like 10, 20, 30,000 people arrested.
And I highly doubt all of these people had involvement. I doubt the majority of these people have an involvement. So to me, he kind of used it as a means to clean up the opposition.
Yeah, you could easily argue that.
And he
that.
Also got the Nationalist Party on his side with that, because before that, they were kind of like a bit of an opposition to his party.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to let everybody know now, this is just our opinions and how we see things. This isn't factual at all. There's no proof or evidence of
this.
There's
proof and evidence.
Well, I mean, I'm sure some of these things...
A lot of them were released because there was no proof that they were involved.
What I mean is there's a lot of things that you could easily debate and argue. I'm not saying I'm disagreeing with you. I'm just saying a lot of this is really up to interpretation and at the same time can be debated easily.
Probably in the Panama Papers somewhere, you know?
To an extent, they can be debated, but there's a bit of truth that is impossible to deny.
We're just laying the facts down. We're not giving our opinion on anything, are we?
I mean, I feel like there is some sort of bias that it can be,
I don't know,
interpreted from what we're saying. Anyways, besides that, so I want to go back to Fethullah Gulen. So after he fled the country, I do. Well, no, I don't like the after. I disagree with every single thing that man stands for 100%.
You don't support that basketball player?
What? Basketball player?
He's talking about NS Kunter.
NS Kunter.
Oh, yeah. I don't really like basketball. So
gives himself the honorary last name Gulen.
Did he do that?
Yeah, he did.
That's interesting. Anyways, so Gulen, so yeah, he fled. What year did he flee exactly? I know it was obviously before 2016. But so yeah, he fled sometime in the late 2000s, early 2010s. And so he fled to the U.S. and he went to the Poconos here in Pennsylvania. That's where his sister owns like a large acre or large piece of land. Then that's where he was staying up until 2016, supposedly. And because in 2016, what happened was in the summer of 2016, there was a coup that happened. It was a small part of the army. It wasn't the whole entire army. It was like a few thousand troops under the command of some small general or some small commander. And they led a coup against the government. And you can even look it up on YouTube. So many people filmed it on their cell phones, what was going on. It was insane. Like, my family members recounting it. Like, luckily, none of them were really close to any of the fighting that was happening. But a lot of the people that were there, they can attest to just how awful that these coup attempters were against the citizens. They literally took attack helicopters, were gunning down people on the streets. They were gunning down people that were on the Istanbul Strait bridges. There were people being run over by tanks. It's a disgusting thing to see. It was awful in every single way possible. These people that were trying to, you know, take over the government, they obviously failed, and you know, luckily, the good thing they did. And again, like I was saying before, because of this small group that attempted this coup, Erdogan and his party used this as an excuse to round up a lot of people that they potentially felt were supporting the coup. And I'm not sure if I actually said this, but the coup is still, people say that it was led by Fethullah Gulen and his generals and whatnot.
Also, just want to mention, for those who don't know, a lot of the followers of Gulen ended up being embedded into the Turkish government, and that's where they gained a lot of power. And after like the falling out, there were still definitely people in the government that were like secretly his followers, or maybe they sympathized with him a little bit. And I guess people theorize that those are the people that attempted the coup in 2016. And of course, you know, it's right that they would get him out of power, but really the problem is they decided to take out anybody who was even like
small-time follower,
right? Or even anybody who was suspected to be his follower. Like, even if somebody told them like, oh, this guy's a Gulenist, they'd be like, okay, straight to jail, no investigation or anything.
Yeah, I've heard some family and friends say that people that were even at one of Gulen's schools when they were a child, and they after the elementary school or whatever, they had literally no ties at all to the school, they would still be suspected as well,
right,
of being like quote unquote the sleeper agents that Gulen talked about, or someone that affiliated and supported him and helped attempt the coup. So I mean, it is a very complex and confusing situation. Obviously, we don't know the true facts. I don't even think the Turkish government really knows the true facts of if whether or not Gulen was involved. They may know. I mean, there is a lot of people that suspect that Erdogan himself attempted this coup. And I mean, you can argue that it is kind of suspicious that Erdogan, he happened to be outside of the country when this coup was attempted, and he called on he was on FaceTime, and one news anchor had him on FaceTime, and they were live streaming it to everyone's TV, and he was saying, "Everybody pour out onto the streets, don't let them take our country." And I mean, I think that is very odd. I don't know why that even happened.
It's like a movie.
You can argue it was coincidental that he was outside of the country, but at the same time, you could argue that it is kind of suspicious that he was outside of the country when this coup attempt happened.
Was he outside of the country? I thought he was in his home in the south, and the military alerted him, so he was on helicopter when he did that.
I heard that he was outside of the country. I think he was on a diplomatic mission to speak with like a foreign president or an ambassador.
Interesting.
That was terrible planning by the coup attempters then, huh? Or was it?
well, I'm saying, like, the thing is, you could argue that it was a good timing because the president was outside the country.
True. But technology allowed him to be on FaceTime and literally.
That's
so many citizens just poured onto the streets and took over tanks and shit like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, regardless of what you believe, you can easily see that this coup attempt, whoever attempted it, was poorly organized and really had no idea how they were going to go about it.
I mean, they said, so different, obviously there's differing things on how this coup went down, but people said like the military uncovered. Like another part of the military uncovered secret transmissions saying they were going to take Erdogan while he's at his house, and then Erdogan was notified by it, and that's why the coup initiated sooner than they wanted to. Whereas I think
I think I heard that too.
Yeah, so they initiated it sooner than they wanted to, and I guess if they did it, and so I think their original plan was to capture Erdogan during the coup, and instead it became to capture the government before Erdogan came back.
I think regardless if they were even able to capture Erdogan, they still wouldn't have been able to really use him as like a bargaining chip. Like, yes, he was really like seen as like the savior as well for the country. Like, I mean, not so much as Atatürk, but to some varying degree, he probably still was close to Atatürk in terms of bringing the country to the first world country playing field. Like I said, it was just poorly organized, whoever organized it. And I'm just glad that, you know, there really wasn't more damage done than what was already done.
Yeah, but we'll see. A lot has changed since Atatürk's time to modern Turkey. They even wrote a new constitution at this point, and there's no longer...
Oh, yeah, that's right.
There is no longer...
There was a referendum that happened a few years ago.
Yep, there's no longer a prime minister of Turkey. Now it's just a sole presidency, because they used to have a prime minister and a president. And to me, it always felt redundant because you only heard about one of the two people doing anything in government. So
I feel like one of them was just there for show.
That's sort of how it felt like. But they got rid of the prime ministership and just left it as a presidency at this point. And so you can see a lot of changes from the time of Atatürk versus the time of Erdogan.
I wonder what Atatürk would say if he saw the current state of the country.
I don't know. I think he'd be happy about some of the progresses it has made and advanced on, and probably be upset at some of the other ones, like the lack of freedom of speech and stuff.
Yeah, I think when it comes to the current state of the economy and the strength of, like, military-wise of the country, he would be very pleased of, because now, like, we can't really be bullied. Like you were saying before, with, like, the censorships and the... some social aspects of the society being oppressed really would disagree with and probably be an activist if he lived today against all that. But we're coming up on just over hour 15 minutes. I think we got through a lot. You know, we talked about the fall of the very end of the fall of the Ottoman Empire, and then the struggle for modern-day Turkey to arise from, you know, occupation by Westerners, and then the constant change and development brought upon to Turkish government, society, the culture, and, you know, see the different ways that it's affected the modern-day Turkey, and, you know, see how it is today. And, you know, going forward, it's really... You really can't speculate too much because anything could really happen, really, especially when you have someone like Erdogan in power that has clearly changed in ideas when it comes to policy and lawmaking. Is there anything that you guys want to add before we sign off?
Well, I just want to mention that Turkish politics is a lot more complex than any other like Western nation.
I agree.
Like the U.S. seems like child play compared to the complexity of the Turkish military. So we can't really give all the details on that. Did I say military? I meant politics. My fault. But yeah, that's just one of the big details of it.
Yeah, I'd also say on top of that, there really is a lot of corruption in the Turkish government. So you really don't know, like, you really wouldn't know who to trust, to be honest. Because, like I said, even the guy that Erdogan, that everybody, or not everybody, a lot of people adore and trust so much and give a lot of credit to, that guy has even changed up on what he has been saying since the beginning of his political career. And not even just him. Other political officials have flip-flopped. They have changed and they've lied. I mean, it's obviously common to see lying politicians everywhere you go. It's pretty much the way of politics. You can't be a politician without saying at least one lie.
Yeah, and Erdogan's not the first to like roll back freedom of speech in Turkey and all of this. Like, this was all started before him, and he just like took it to its furthest extent, which is one of the main issues with the government Atatürk created, because it left leniencies for stuff like this to happen, unfortunately. And so leads to rise of people like Erdogan, unfortunately. But we'll see in the next election what Turkey decides and what path it wants to take. I'm looking forward to seeing how it goes.
Yeah, me too. It's really interesting. I mean, I'm not going to live in Turkey anytime soon. I highly doubt I will. Maybe when I'm older, I'll change my mind. So it's not really going to affect me directly. But since I have most of my family there, and I really do care about the state of the government and the state of the society, I don't want anything to happen to them, obviously. I really want what's best for everybody there. So hopefully things do work out for the best. And on that note, guys, hope you enjoyed the little background of modern-day Turkey, the Republic of Turkey. And we'll see you guys on the next episode. Have a nice day. Bye.
See you.
Bye.